Well, aloha. Thank you for not going to the beach and coming to this place. I know it's hard. So at the expense of being a bit audacious, I'm going to change the definition of perennial breeding because I don't work with annual crops. I work with a lot of temperate crops, several of them, including tree fruits, nuts, and berries. And we've kind of developed our own definition. So before I jump in, this is a workshop, and you know, Ted told me don't talk about your own research, but kind of give an overview, one. Secondly, I wanted to make it interactive so that anybody who's dozing off can wake up. So my first question is, are there any people over here, except for the ones I know, at least one, who works with temperate perennial crops? One, two, three, yeah, there are a few people, all right. Any tropical crop people here? No mangoes or all right. Well, so this presentation is basically on temperate crops, but there are some applications across two other aspects as well. So what are we really trying to do here? I mean, we're trying to fight a few of the major threats to food production, which not only affect subsistence-related crops, but also our high-value crops, which we call specialty crops. I like to call them as food crops versus row crops. Climate change, you believe it or not, it's happening. There's ample evidence everywhere. I think I'm in the audience of scientists, so you can understand. We have depleted our soil qualities. We need to really develop crops that can produce well in these environments. Water is becoming limiting as well. One season of good rain doesn't really make up for the droughts that we see. And of course, we have to find energy for all of this. So how do we really address some of these big questions that are not going to become problems 10 years, 15, 20 years. They are here now. We're dealing with them now. And the reason I'm making this point is because when I say now, it's critical that we focus on the time factor as well. So this is one question for, I saw a lot of hands raised, so you have already shown yourself, so you can't hide anymore. You have to answer. So what is the key issue inherent in perennial crop breeding? I just want to hear from the audience. This is your chance to participate. It is a workshop, remember? I'm taking notes. Well, okay. Well, that's the good part. There are lots of them, but what is one thing that you can change that can really alter the entire process? One thing in perennial crops that you can change? Speed up? Okay. Sorry, say that again. Anybody else agree or disagree? Anything else? Okay. That was the point. You get the gold star. I don't have one yet, but but thank you. That's the point over here. So we are trying to solve the fourth dimension that we have not had to address in the past because we had ample time, but not anymore because we are really facing some of these crises around us. So how do we achieve precision? And this is where my definition of precision breeding is a little bit different from what we heard earlier. We want to reduce the time between generations, and there are multiple approaches one can take, horticultural approaches, genetic approaches, transgenic intermediate approaches, enhancement of efficiencies in progeny selection, of course, molecular markers. Don't worry, I'm not going to speak too much about genomics. Actually, my program is in genomics and biotech. That will be a separate talk later on, maybe next year. And then one point that Bob made last in his talk, how do we cash in on previous gains? We have spent three, four decades developing some of the best crops, and they always have this one little problem, Achilles' heel. Why can't we fix that first? Because every time we make a cross, we have to go through the same process of generation time and selection over and over again. So that's where genome editing comes in. This is my kind of comprehensive definition, and I think we have to remember that definitions, languages, cultures are always changing with the times. And I think that's where I come from, that, okay, precision breeding was transgenic maybe in 2004. Not anymore. In our context, it encompasses more than just moving a gene back and forth. We have to combine all of these approaches. So I'm going to briefly discuss all of these three points, give you guys an overview. Have a little smattering of my own research, not too much. I have tried to stay away from that, but I just wanted to show you some success, especially in the first part that we are doing. We are working on all these three areas, of course, but I just want to highlight that. So, So we work with some of the high, you know, we are the horticultural sciences meeting. These are some of the major crops, horticultural crops. I want you to kind of take note that generation times are pretty high, especially apple and pears that I work on. It's about 6 to 12 years, and avocado is 15 plus years. And recently I've been visiting some of the Asian countries where they grow a lot of apples and pears. They're using seedling rootstock for their grafting Red Delicious or Fujis. And the first 10 to 12 years, those trees do not bear any fruit. I mean, it's sort of appalling for us to hear in the U.S. Well, we're in Hawaii, but it's appalling for us to hear in the U.S. because we already expect fruit in the second, third year. But not too long ago, in the 70s, 80s, U.S. was also using a lot of these rootstocks, seedling rootstocks, which had long juvenility periods. And with the change in labor requirements, change in EPA requirements, change in economics, of course, the orchards are changing. So I just wanted you to remember this part. That's what we're dealing with. And that's why developing a new variety, I mean, Honeycrisp is a great example. The cross was made in the 1960s, and it was almost three decades later that it was released. It has taken 40 years for a Honeycrisp to come. I mean, it's not the best apple, I mean, in terms of agronomic aspects, but definitely there are issues with what the times we are in. We need to move fast. Okay, so just wanted to give you a little 101 on the seasonal growth and development model. Just as I promised about overview over here, we are looking at these are 2 years, two seasons that I've kind of put together. There's a first period of aggressive growth. The growth slows down and plant starts to grow paradormant. It enters endodormancy and then it requires its chilling, endodormancy. And you know, depending on the species, these number of hours that you need for cold can vary. And based on that, you can determine where to grow these plants, basically. And this cycle continues year after year, of course. And in horticulture, in tropical crops, of course, there are similar phenotypic changes. Plants don't go into a very long-term ecodormancy, but you can superimpose some of these ideas. So what we've done in our program is we started trying to see if we can accelerate this part. Can we condense these two or three cycles within 1 year? And we actually developed a pretty comprehensive phenotypic process. I don't have all the images here, but we were able to see when the plant is going into paradormancy, when it is endodormant, and then provide it the chilling requirement. Basically, we would grow these things in the greenhouse. We'll push the growth through both horticultural management, through nutrition, as well as light, and then give it to the satisfy the ecodormancy requirement. This is a cold chamber photograph. And we did the same with pears. And we were basically able to get the pear seedlings to flower within 3 years. If you recall the first slide I showed you, it takes about 6 to 12 years. So we've been able to really push the cycles two and a half cycles in 12 months to get this material. And this is just pure horticultural management. And during this process, we also evaluated a 1970s dogma that it requires at least 120 nodes to flower, and that's not true. It may have been true for the study done with the particular specific species of specific variety of apples in Cornell. That's kind of became the mainstay that, oh, you need 120 nodes before it flowers. That's not true. The other one we did was we actually combined this cycling with better genetics. This was a project we started a few years ago at WSU. Bruce Barrett, who used to be our apple breeder, we all brainstormed with Kate Evans, Cameron Peace. We all kind of got together and identified Malus Zumai to be a highly precocious variety. And how do we bring in that genetics? We had some other aspects also included in that. So we were able to get flowers from seed germination within 365 days. So it did require two cycles of compressing this growth model that I just showed you earlier. So this is pure horticultural management. In a way, I think we are saving time, so I call it as a component of the precision breeding program, basically. The second part of this is the fast track, which is the transgenic intermediate process. And this is also something my lab's been working with. The first transgenics in apple which flowered continuously were developed in Germany by Viola Hanke's group. So I got those materials back in 2008. And we've been working with this. So in this particular process, what you do is you take a particular variety that you want to work with. You want to, in this particular case, the example is developing a fruit tree with heat tolerance. So you have a wild apple, which is heat tolerant, which is not here, but you have a seedling from the original desired types. Let's say we want to make Honeycrisp now, we want it to become heat tolerant. So I'm going to walk you through this. You'll have to work with me a little bit here. We'll walk through this. So what we do is we'll take the Honeycrisp, we will genetically transform with this early continually flowering gene, and we will obtain, in step one, we will obtain a transgenic. So this is Honeycrisp now, which is flowering continuously. Thereafter, we will cross it. This is step 2A. We will cross it with a heat-tolerant genotype. And because of simple Mendelian inheritance, and assuming that our transgene is a single-copy gene, with GeneGun, you usually don't get a single-copy gene, but let's select for one. It's a game of numbers. You can actually get a lot of transgenic events and select the one which is, even if it's not a single copy, at least it's Mendelian, showing Mendelian inheritance, basically a single locus perhaps. And there are several studies showing that when you use the gene gun, there are hotspots in the genome where the genes will go and establish themselves through illegitimate recombination. So 25% of these genes should have the early continually flowering gene as well as the heat tolerant gene. And thereafter, you have to do some more gymnastics of back crossing. Remember, in this we have lost the Honeycrisp now, right? We started crossing things, we've lost it. We have some genetics left from there, but we've lost it. So you keep on doing several back crosses to bring back the Honeycrisp background as much as you can. And this is a great place if you know that the molecular markers that are associated with both, you already know the heat-tolerant one, most likely, and you also know the one for the Honeycrisp or the transgene. Obviously, you can track down the transgene definitely. And you try to select the ones which do not have the transgene but do have the heat-tolerant trait in them. And thereby, you are able to select a plant that is heat-tolerant but non-ECF, non-early continually flowering. So this is nothing new. This is an old concept. There have been several varieties released through this process, specifically in the Netherlands. There is a group, Henk Schouten's group actually has done some work with this, and of course in Germany, Viola Hanke's group has done this. The question is, why was this being done? You know, now the final product is obviously does not have a transgene, and I don't know if there's another group at USD Akron as well. Ralph Scorza's group had done a similar approach in plums. I think we were still waiting to hear what is USDA's position on this, if that has been clarified or not. Will this be considered GMO or not? Or I actually don't want to use the word GMO. Genetically engineered is the correct term because we all are genetically modified as well. If anybody has doubts, let's meet up later on, okay? Nobody's a clone of their parents. So that's kind of in a nutshell. There's been a lot of effort put into this approach to over... Okay, I just have 3 minutes. All right. I'll rush through. The best part is yet to come. Okay, so the next part is, of course, genomics, which is marker-assisted breeding. Everybody knows about it, so I'm not going to belabor the point. The point is you basically find a dominant marker that kind of goes with the trait. You don't have to select all the seedlings. You can eliminate all the seedlings that don't have the desirable trait, for example, over here you're looking for. But what's happening inside these big crops with polyploid genomes with large genome sizes? This is a very complex slide. I don't want you to read that. All I want to do to show you is that in a traditional breeding process with an apple or a pear, you're looking at a 5 to 7 year time between each cycle, generation cycle. And through genomic selection, which sounds magical, but it requires a lot of work, a priori information needs to be available on the genomes. You need to understand how genes and traits relate to each other. You can then, once you have developed that information, this is more of a future thing. Once we have that, we can predict what recombination events we are looking for the seedling. So you're not looking at one marker at a time. This is a genome screen there where you can look at each chromosome along its length and find the right alleles to really find the predicted alleles. Mark my point, it's predicted alleles because one of the things we forget sometimes when we think purely genetics is protein-protein interaction, gene-to-gene networks. Those also need to be evaluated. How do the metabolic pathways kind of come together? So it's not that simplistic to say. So just to summarize this first part, long juvenile periods between generations can be overcome by horticultural or environmental interventions. Introgression of the early flowering trait, this could be non-transgenic approach. Utilizing a transgenic intermediate approach, or utilizing genomic selection to identify the best combination of traits. Again, I think hort research or plant food and agriculture in New Zealand is trying to utilize the genomic selection for developing some of the new varieties of apples. These approaches can be obviously used alone or in combination. There are obvious limitations. Environmental interventions require specific, specialized infrastructure. Given the fact that universities are cash-strapped everywhere across the globe, it's not easy. Use of transgenic intermediates comes with regulatory burden. We need to prove that there is no transgenic elements in there or any foreign elements. And genomic selection also needs establishments of marker trait associations and marker screening infrastructure. So it's not very simple because you're not just screening one marker. You're screening 30,000 or a million markers, especially when you go to that genome scale. You can do SNPs, SNP arrays, but SNP arrays are only limited to the system that you're working with. If you have new elite varieties or new exotic cultivars coming in due to the ascertainment by SNP arrays have their own limitations, but they work for a given specific set of work. So I'll switch to genome editing quickly. Ted said I can keep going, so you guys can stop.
I would just say my intention originally was to have each of these be 20 minutes or so and have a little bit of time, but when they printed the schedule, they printed out as 15 minutes.
I know.
Okay.
And I talked about that now, and they said we can have all the time we want to check the bus. So,
the best part is now. All right. I won't take too much time. Anyway, so I think genome editing is so much in the news, I don't need to educate this audience. I'm sure that you pick up a newspaper and it's right there it is. They have genome edited an embryo, they have genome edited out a cancer disease, everything. But we poor plant people keep wondering, really? Everything's working for humans and animals, what about us? What about plants, I mean, not us. Plants have a different challenge, it has always been the case. And that's what I just want to talk about that briefly over here. So genome editing is a genetic engineering approach, not in the regulatory terms, but manipulating the genome, where we can insert, remove, or replace, or knock out a precise location within the genome. But for this, you need to know, first of all, what to do, where to target. That approach needs to be taken if the goal is to change something, if the goal is to modify a trait. It's all based on engineered nucleases, which were discovered from bacteria. Some of them were, and these are recombination-based approaches where there are two methods that are prominently used, non-homologous end-joining process as well as homology-directed repair. Some of the nuclease-based genome editing processes are zinc finger nucleases, meganucleases, TALENs, and CRISPRs. I'm not going to go over the first two. I'll briefly touch number three and mostly spend some time on CRISPR because that seems to be the most generically applicable or most broadly applicable approach. For zinc finger and TALENs, you need to have, especially for zinc finger, you need to have very specific motifs which are not available throughout the genome. So this is TALENs. It's an engineered nuclease which will cut at a desired position in the genome. It's basically, you can read it too, but transcription activator-like effector nucleases discovered in Xanthomonas. These are basically TAL arrays that basically go and clamp a portion of the genome, and the enzyme FOC1 is able to excise the DNA and thereby create some mutations that can be later on identified. This is my favorite, and I think everybody's favorite, so I wanted to get to this slide first. Okay, so CRISPRs are clustered regulatory interspaced short palindromic repeats. You can actually develop two types of breaks. You can get blunt ends, basically flush ends, or you can get staggered cut ends. So you have to just use Cas9 or CPF1 enzyme. These are two different nucleases that can go in there. So the complex, this is the Cas9 protein that forms a complex with guide RNA and finds its complementary sequence in the genome, and it's able to go and do multiple things. You can either, I think I have another slide which can show you that. You can use HDR-mediated repair, homology-directed repair to make single nucleotide alterations, or you can also do precise sequence insertions through this process. So you can start rebuilding the blocks inside the genome, whereas TALENs are mostly for insertion or deletion mutants. So what happens in plants? There are two approaches we can take, and this is something that Bob had mentioned earlier. This is a workflow developed for Arabidopsis, where things are easy. You can close your eyes, dip the flowers, and get the transgenic. We don't work with those systems. Well, sometimes we do just to kind of live in fairyland. So there are two approaches. One, you can actually have stably install the CRISPR-Cas9 cassette with the guide RNA inside the plant and basically get your T0 plants for homozygous mutations and then get to the next generation because these are self-compatible and you are able to get rid of the transgene and just recover the mutation. Most of the crops I work with are self-incompatible. This approach doesn't go any far. We have to stay at F1 unless we cross with some other variety which is compatible, so we have to really keep going in crosses. The other one is to do a transient system where we have to develop cell suspension culture, especially in our systems. And we have started doing some of that work to develop these suspension systems or intermediate single cell protoplast, but not real protoplast systems where we can then target some of the mutations. Some of the work we are doing in the past, we've collaborated with Professor Dory Main's program and Professor Eric Rolson's program at WSU, where we had identified locus for powdery mildew resistance, and we already have some plant material right now, which is genome edited for that. It's a knockout in a particular locus to look for a complete powdery mildew resistance, which I'm trying to get to Michael so that he can do the bioassay. So the previous answer that we will always need pathologists is so true. So the general approach is that you choose a species, choose wisely, because if it's not self-compatible, obviously you have to go another way. Select the gene and the region to be targeted. That's a big part of this thing. If you really want to modify a trait that you know, you select the guide RNA based on predicted on-target and off-target activity. There is a guide RNA design software that can help you with that. You synthesize and clone the desired guide RNAs and then deliver that and validate the genome edit. It seems pretty simple, but you know, delivery, it could be through Agrobacterium or through GeneGun. We use both approaches in our lab. For the new species, you know, prior gene trait knowledge is important and it allows for trait modification. If no a priori knowledge is available, if you perform this process, it can help you establishing gene function or information about gene function. So there is a way for gene discovery, gene function discovery through this process as well. Initially, candidate gene approach can be utilized, and phylogenetic relationships can be used to identify target genes. So in the MLO study we had published in 2013, we had also identified several homologs in grapevines and apples. Right now, we are targeting those through this process as well. I just wanted to give a small ode to the PAM site. PAM is the protospacer adjacent motif. This is a very short sequence, three to six nucleotide. If it is not the right kind, game over. Your CRISPR-Cas9 will keep swimming in the soup and will not make any contact with the thing. And we've worked with several vectors that have been provided by Donald Week's program as well as recently from AdGene. We have found that the AdGene vectors are more amenable for genome editing purposes. And the target, your guide RNA needs to land adjacent to the native PAM site inside the genome. That's the big difference. The efficiency really goes up. And there are several studies. Every day somebody's publishing that if you change, tweak one base pair, the efficiency goes up. The caution with all these studies is they are not testing all the approaches all at once. They are basically referring to literature. So it's almost like what works in your hand with your system. That's the most important part. And one system does not work for all species. And I also work with strawberry, which is an octoploid. So that's another nightmare to work with because now you're dealing with, you know, eight pairs of chromosomes. How do you ensure that you have mutations in all eight homologs or homologs? So that's an interesting aspect to look at. So just some of the summary of this part, some challenges and future directions. Delivery into plants, transgenic intermediates or cell suspensions, what do you go with? Right now we are trying to work primarily with transgenic intermediates while developing cell suspensions. So I have an interesting anecdote. I come from a lab in India that first discovered haploids in Datura in 1964. Guhan Maheshwari, this was a science paper in 1964. And, you know, at the time, there were big promises made about how haploids were going to change the world, right? It is after 5 decades that we are really utilizing them, both in genomics and we are utilizing them in a lot of the other wheat breeding purposes right now. So similarly, I think tissue culture approaches really were being developed in the 50s, 60s with a big push and kind of declined. But I think if we really want to be able to utilize these platforms, we have to revisit some of those approaches one more time. There's a big problem with off-target effects in humans that can be devastating, but in plants, they're a little bit more resilient. But how do we really make it precise? So there is a recent report. It's called the fourth generation CRISPR-Cas9. It is actually including, they include another enzyme, uracil N-glycosylase. Once you include this enzyme in animal systems, it makes the editing extremely precise. It does not allow editing offsite. So this is another, how do we now translate that to plant systems? This needs to be seen. When we do knockouts in plant genomes, there are so many duplications. You know, what about compensatory expression changes that come along? There'll be inbuilt redundancy. So we have to really look at those aspects as well. Sometimes we may not discover. We might find a mutation, but the phenotype's missing. So we still need to do some breeding segregation analysis thereafter. There might be some effects due to G-by interactions. So that also make the mutation and the resulting phenotype undetectable. So some of the future directions we are working on, and I think the whole field is working on, is developing plant-specific approaches. I feel sometimes very envious of the animal people, how every day they have a new paper in Nature, how they are breaking the barriers of genome editing. Increased specificity specifically in plants, efficient recovery of mutated events in plants, and obviously it's a hats off to the next presenter about the regulatory landscape as well. So this is my definition. I hope you have a sense of humor and you also like Pink Floyd. In the past, we could go for decades developing new varieties. We just don't have the time anymore. So I think one thing we are trying to solve, precision, what in my definition, whenever I think about precision breeding, I think of one thing, time. And that kind of translates into multiple dimensions that we want to look at. In the end, I would like to acknowledge the and thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity. The research in my lab is funded through different programs, but some of the work I've talked about, shown you, is funded by the commodity groups, USA Pears, and Washington Tree Fruit Research Commission. And also, I have a little plug for a spinoff from my lab at WSU. We're hiring. A lot of this precision breeding approaches that we've developed over the last decade are being utilized to develop some of these new crops, apple, pear, cherry, grape, and several other berry crops. So if anybody's interested, please look into these, or I can talk to you later on. Thank you very much.